Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, a show featuring the people, stories, and events of Central Iowa. We're your hosts for today, Greta Anderson and Ursula Rudenberg. Hello, Ursula.
Hi, Greta, and hello to you, the listener.
Later in the show, we have a special treat for our listeners, a Nevada, Iowa poet who has been touring the nation with the publication of her latest book. That book was reviewed in the New York Times. We'll be dropping by to read us a couple of her poems.
And also later, we'll be checking in with Campus Town, where there's a lot of change happening, and we'll have a discussion about its history and some of its future with our friend Ngadia and an in-studio guest, the writer Andy Capps, who's doing a research project on the history of Campus Town.
But for now, Local Talk listeners, I hope you have a cup of coffee handy. You may need it to keep up with our next guest, Dave Swenson, who I spoke with over the weekend about the subject of economic development in Iowa. Dave has been working at the Iowa State University Department of Economics for over 30 years, where he is associate scientist specializing in local and regional economic development. I wanted to talk to David for a couple of reasons. One of them was that a few weeks back, the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities released a study about job creation all over the country, which showed that the vast majority of new jobs came from what they call indigenous sources, people who were born and educated in the state and developed an idea, started a business, and that grew, or from companies that already existed in the state and were growing. Only a tiny fraction, only about 3% or so of new jobs come from corporations that relocate from another state. The title of the report was, quote, State Job Creation Strategies Often Off Base. This is because, as we see in Iowa, many of the biggest packages and biggest headlines go to out-of-state corporations who invest in Iowa. I asked David Swenson for his local take on this national study, and he immediately got started talking about how this idea of investment is off base. What do you think, David? Do we have a good job creation strategy in this state of Iowa?
The answer, the short answer and the categorical answer is no. But most states don't. Job creation strategies within states usually center around inducements to try to attract businesses. We used to call it smokestack chasing, trying to get another manufacturing firm. Over the years, as the wind blows, our governments will swing from one thing to the next. They might have swung to IT. They might swing to biotech because that's an area here that we have some prominence. And just 8 years ago or 9 years ago, everybody was seeking green jobs. So we go all over the place trying to chase jobs. And as you noted, though, that most jobs aren't caught. Most jobs just simply occur, and they occur because of the initiative of people that just happen to be in our communities. Or there are other businesses that are already here, and they're slowly expanding because they've been successful. And that's where the vast majority of jobs come from. Yet the money we spend on economic development very often involves trying to chase Grand Slam home runs, trying to get an automobile plant, trying to get a chemical plant, trying to get something that looks like a great big deal that other states are in competition for, and it oftentimes comes at a very, very high price. Iowa isn't the only state that does this. Some of the states are just as bad as Iowa, like some of the states down south, Mississippi, South Carolina, Alabama, intense competition, for example, for automobile manufacturers. So this interstate competition for capital, this interstate competition used to be for jobs, but now it's really just capital. It's investment. Has accelerated over the years. And Iowa is one of those states that just as aggressively as any other state will try to chase a firm.
Okay, before we get into the details with Iowa, can you explain a bit the difference between luring capital and luring jobs or chasing capital?
Sure. What's happened over the years is economic developers, again, especially in a state like Iowa, they've counted their success not in the amount of jobs that they've been able to either stimulate or to develop or to in one way or another claim on their balance sheet. They've shifted from that more towards the value of capital investment. How much investment investment have we been made? As if you look at the Iowa Department of Economic Development here in the state of Iowa, they very, very often talk more about the value of what they've been able to lure to the state of Iowa than the number of jobs. There's a great example of that. We have, it's just being finished up, a fertilizer plant in southeast Iowa, very, very expensive plant. The Iowa State Economic Development Authority has touted it as a great big success. This is a project that will cost over $1 billion to complete. But it's also a project that we've underwritten either through federal, state, or local assistance upwards of $500 million worth of subsidy. And what they're claiming is this capital investment, somehow the state of Iowa is now worth more, but that project is only going to hire 165 people. And that works out to something like $3 million per job, which is dumb. And that's not the way it used to be. It used to be, how many jobs could we try to develop with the least amount of public cost? That's been thrown out the window now. And what they really talk about is capital investment, the capital chase.
Now, if the fertilizer plant costs $1 billion, are they going to have to pay property taxes on $1 billion now?
Well,
you know, when you have property, you have to pay property tax. Will they have to pay property tax?
Oh, no.
On that?
Part of the subsidy was that the Lee County gave them 20 years worth of a property tax break. So they don't have to pay any property taxes on their property that they developed. And as a matter of fact, when they do pay property taxes on that property, after 20 years, that property will have depreciated by 2/3 for property tax purposes. This, they've shot themselves in the foot. They boast about what they've done and claim that they're enhancing their region's economy, but they're not. They're shifting tax burdens to everybody else by giving a pass to this very large corporation by saying, you're so special, you don't have to pay taxes. It's not just state government, it's local governments as well. And they do this by primarily through tax increment financing. They just use the property taxes that the company would owe. They just simply rebate them and say, oh, thank you, and here you can have the check back.
Okay, so, I mean, to me, that seems like the real value of having more investment in a state or in a county or anywhere is that you can then assess it and tax it.
But that you're exactly right. We do want a reasonable amount of investment so that we can tax it. We want also people who are working so that we do two things. One, they provide them incomes. They spend those incomes in the regional economy. There's a multiplier effect. That's all fine and good. They also, though, pay taxes as well. Now, they also consume public goods. They consume local education. They consume the highways. They consume everything. They don't generate more taxes necessarily than they consume in public goods. So we have to be careful how we account that. But I want to back up. Economic development, the mere provision of jobs on average, isn't a public good. It's a private good. It's a public good, and it's a public responsibility if we have a problem with an area that has chronic unemployment. Iowa has one of the lowest unemployment rates in the state. So the whole idea of using public money to entice more job growth, unless you're targeting specific groups of people who have trouble finding work or that there's some sort of structural barriers keeping them from working, you're not producing a public good where you're doing something the market isn't doing. You're producing a private good, which, again, is just producing employment for people who are going to work in Iowa. They very well may already be in Iowa or more than likely are going to move to Iowa to take these jobs. And, again, even enticing people to come to the state of Iowa isn't a public good. The public good part of using public money is to try to make better the standard of living, the quality of life for Iowans who are currently here.
So if you were creating high-paying jobs or jobs for people with college educations, for instance, the many college-educated people that we produce out of the Iowa State University or University of Iowa— that might be a public good.
That's a good point, because we produce way more talent than our economy can use. So that talent, a big fraction of that talent in our community colleges, but especially in our regents institutions, it leaves the state because our economy can't use that talent. The way it's configured, the size of our economy just can't hire all those people. So an economic development strategy that promotes the kind of business recruitment that truly capitalizes on something like that, yes, that could be considered a public good. But the best way to do that is produce smart people, have smart, good, and honest government, adequate infrastructure, an acceptable bundle of amenities so people want to live here, and generally modest to low taxes. And we have all of those things. What we need to do is more of it, especially in the human capital side and especially on the infrastructure side. We need to have the best roads. We need to have the best airports. We need to have the best educated people in the state of Iowa. That's the ticket to economic development.
And that's David Swenson, associate economist from the Iowa State University. This is Local Talk. I spoke with Dave this past Saturday about the economic development strategy of Iowa. And as it happened, that morning's Des Moines Register had a front page story that played right into our discussion. Well, I was going to ask about a headline from today's paper about a $17 million deal that the state made with DuPont and Dow Chemical, who are merging. And I understand that we're paying them so they won't cut more jobs.
That's essentially what's happened. Dow and DuPont are merging. DuPont, a few years ago, took over or bought Pioneer Hybrid Seed. So when we think of DuPont here in the state of Iowa, what we're really talking about is Pioneer. We're also talking about that new ethanol plant just east of town. So there are other DuPont-related enterprises and activities in the state of Iowa. Now, what's going on is the headquarters, the corporate headquarters, is being moved to Wilmington, Delaware. But what the state of Iowa was interested in was maintaining its Johnston presence. Now, over the last decade, even more than a decade, the Pioneer Hybrid and then DuPont has expanded markedly in the Johnston area. It has a very, very large footprint. Most of that expansion was subsidized by the state of Iowa and by the city of Johnston and by the Des Moines Area Community College. So they've received millions and millions and millions of subsidy as they've built up this campus and capacity in central Iowa. There was a sense, or at least they claimed, that these jobs were at risk. Some 2,600 of these jobs were at risk if this merger went through and they reorganized everything. And so now the state of Iowa says it has offered and they'll accept $17 million worth of assistance to DuPont, now Dow, DuPont, Dow DuPont, and so that they were going to keep these jobs in the community. The problem with this is there was never any information that said that those jobs were at risk of leaving the community. There was no evidence that these jobs were at risk at all. Yet the state of Iowa has subsidized basically this merger, and it's a continuation of a subsidy. It was reported in the Des Moines Register that DuPont Pioneer has received over $60 million worth of assistance from the state of Iowa over the last 10 or 15 years. Now we add $17 million to that. Another website that I looked at called Good Jobs First actually puts that number for the state of Iowa for all DuPont-related activities at $120 million. This is a company that has been very, very good at extracting public resources from the state of Iowa. And in the process of either declining or perhaps promising not to decline more, they actually got another extraction of $17 million. And as a matter of fact, the amount of money we're giving this company for its R&D activity to not leave, they say, is more than the state of Delaware gave to the headquarters to locate in the headquarters in Wilmington, Delaware. So it's bizarre. It's out of control. It makes no sense. I'll give you one more example. Just a few years ago, the state of Iowa gave these investment credits, capital development credits, to Principal, wonderful company in Des Moines. Principal wasn't hiring any more people. It was just simply renovating its facilities. And they renovated their facilities, and the state of Iowa and Polk County and Des Moines also gave them tax breaks just to renovate their facility. What any other business would have to do as a normal course of business activity has now become subsidized by the state. So we've pumped a lot of this money into these kinds of things, but the frustrating result of this is that they don't put money, or they don't have programs, or they're not doing the kinds of things maybe that would help develop indigenous industries, whether it's startups, whether it's incubators. We have a research park out here in Iowa State University. There are incubators in other places, like at the University of Iowa. But activities and spending in support of business development starting small is a long, slow process. And the state of Iowa isn't very good at that because politicians take credit for job creation and these sort of big news items. The roll up your sleeves and help the economy kind of stuff that really has to go on isn't very pretty. It's kind of ugly. You have a lot of failures. You have to talk about training. You have to think in terms of design and the characteristics of economy. Some places you have to say, no, you can't do this because you don't have the capacity to be this. So it requires a kind of leadership and technical assistance level that we've moved away from. And what we've moved much more towards is marketing and promotion. And that leads to the kind of goofy economic development that we've been living with.
Okay. So marketing and promoting the state.
Sure.
Okay. So just to clarify, this Principal Financial Group, they received money from the state to change their carpet?
Yeah, exactly. To renovate their facility, to make it much more modern, to perhaps put some more technology in because technology had changed since it was first built. But basically, all they did was renovate their facility. They didn't hire any more people. There was no job creation. And the state of Iowa said, well, that fits our criteria because you're investing in Iowa. You're investing.
Now, in all of these cases, when you're talking about investment, it usually takes people on the ground building things. So it seems like the construction industry is always somewhat of a beneficiary mm-hmm. of these kinds of investments. How does that weigh into things?
Well, the construction industry does, and they will benefit. They'll benefit from what happened in Southeast Iowa, Orascom. We have another fertilizer plant now that's going up in near Sioux City. By the way, that company bought the Orascom thing, and it is now one great big fertilizer conglomerate combination. Those are two great big things, but they're just like the ethanol plants. The ethanol plants were great, except that most of the high-skilled jobs required to build the ethanol plants, to put them together, they didn't come from Iowa. They came from Oklahoma. They came from Louisiana. They came from Kansas. They came from places that had a long history of building what is essentially a chemical refinery. Same thing with the new cellulosic ethanol plant out near Nevada. If I went by and I got kicked out of there for doing it, I went by and I was looking at the license plates of all the trucks in the parking lot while they were building it. And fewer than 1 in 10 of them at the time I was there was from Iowa. So you can see, yes, it's construction jobs. Yes, it's good for an economy to a degree. But those workers, they send that paycheck back home because they got bills at home to pay. They don't send that paycheck here in Iowa. So construction is sometimes a red herring. Construction, yeah, how about construction for roads? That hires people here in Iowa. Rebuilding bridges, those are Iowa people. Building chemical plants in Southeast Iowa, most skilled workers come from out of state.
I thought you were going to throw in a pipeline, a crude oil pipeline.
We've been down that pipeline road. There's some contention as to how many jobs are going to be built with the pipeline. The issue with the pipeline wasn't that Iowa didn't have the skills to make a pipeline. Iowa's construction industry is really fully employed. It has more people working in construction than before the recession. And so the argument that there's an idle workforce out there looking for these kinds of jobs just doesn't wash. And what we learned in that Bakken pipeline deal is that the prime contractors are from out of state. They're going to bring their talent in from out of state. Their best jobs are going to come in from out of state. And then they're going to hire what they need as they move along. And so they're going to hire civil engineers, and they're going to hire engineering operators, and they're going to hire welders and pipe fitters and that along the way. But most of the good jobs, or a large fraction of those good jobs, aren't going to go to Iowans.
Okay. And we've also had many successes in luring high-tech industries here to the state, it seems. We've got Google and Facebook and
Microsoft in West Des Moines. Those are all data centers. Now, you're going to be surprised that I'm going to say these are no big deal. And these are no big deal. They're great, big, very expensive capital projects. They qualify for public assistance, state assistance. Again, they hardly hire – they have very few employees. They pay them pretty well, but maybe there's 40, 45 employees working at one of these facilities. So you have this massive – present, this massive footprint, and I call them great big hot boxes. That's all they are. They're just this massive consumer of electricity. But they don't link to anything else in the rest of the state's economy. The only thing they're buying from the state's economy is electricity. And everything else that went into that building, all the special mechanical and technical and computer and all of that, that wasn't made in Iowa. We maybe put up the building. Somebody in Iowa put up the building. But all the innards, the valuable stuff, none of that came from Iowa. And again, probably the vast majority of what was constructed and then installed required out-of-the-state labor. So we fool ourselves by saying, well, look at this capital investment that Facebook is making in the state of Iowa, and now we're really up there in IT. No, that's not IT. That's just pumping out, you know, information into the ether and consuming electricity. And I argue it's perfectly good. They're great, but we shouldn't be subsidizing these things. Either they're coming to the state of Iowa because they can get cheap electricity, which is why they come to the state of Iowa, and they can also claim some green credits with the windmills by saying that they're pumping out green energy. Well, that windmill electricity goes into the pool. We call it fungible. Everybody gets to claim it. I claim it. You claim it. Everybody says we're greener just because we have windmills in the state of Iowa. They claim they're very green because they have windmills.
Okay. This is Local Talk, and I'm one of your hosts, Greta Anderson. We're listening to my conversation with ISU economist Dave Swenson over the weekend. I hope to continue to pursue this story in future editions of Local Talk by speaking with local legislators, particularly Dave Dio of Nevada, who is the chair of the House Economic Development Appropriations Committee. So I asked Dave Swenson what policies could or should be promoted at the state level for healthier growth. Here's what David said. If you are going to impact state policy, where can you impact it?
Sure. There's a lot of things. First of all, if you can't control all of the behaviors, you start putting incremental controls. And incremental controls, for example, may limit the amount of money, for example, the state could award to any individual firm. Orascom got $133 million worth of state tax credits. What it means is that Orascom doesn't have to pay taxes over a period of years. They get their tax bill for zero. And that's going to amount to quite a lot of money because Orascom, what they make is going to get sold in Iowa, and that's why it would get taxed. By the way, that's another issue. You know, in Iowa, somebody like Rockwell Collins doesn't sell very much of what they make in Iowa, so they don't pay any Iowa taxes. Yet we subsidize them with research activity tax credits and other kinds of public assistance. So we have this big bundle of credits. First of all, these credits should have limited amounts. I don't know how much, maybe $5 million, maybe $10 million, maybe less. I don't know if you're going to do it, but at least start spreading these credits around so you don't throw all of this money into one pot. Second of all, develop job creation goals to these credits, not capital formation goals. We're interested in jobs and jobs that align with Iowa needs. So what we need are job creating status strategies, not capital investment strategies. Third, you should have a set of criteria that emphasize indigenous growth, helping companies expand, helping companies develop new products, helping companies with perhaps their training, which are things that we can be doing, but really less towards recruiting a firm from out of state and building up what we already have here. Fourth, we need to start paying attention to parts of the state that aren't doing well. We have a very, very healthy metropolitan economy. Ames, Iowa City, Des Moines metropolitan areas, very, very healthy. But if you go down one level of city, what's called micropolitan, the cities from 10,000 up to, in Iowa, it's about 35,000, almost all of them have not recovered back to the employment level they had prior to the recession. The state of Iowa has no programs that are systematically addressing these micropolitan economies, stabilizing these micropolitan economies, investigating what their needs are, what their deficiencies are, what their assets are, marketing them and assisting them. And if we spent more of that kind of assistance in stabilizing these regional economies, I think we'd have a stronger, healthier rural economy, because that's where people go to work. And those are the kinds of strategies that I'd recommend. And then the fifth one, education, education, education. Get everybody in school and keep them in school. Don't let anybody, don't let them get away with just getting a high school education. Keep them in school one more year, two more years. It makes a difference. And anything the state of Iowa can do with its workforce to do that is important, and especially for its minority workforce and its minority members, because they're disproportionately marginalized by the economy.
Okay. And it sounds like we need to just stop our ears when we hear politicians claiming jobs created.
They do not create jobs. They do not create jobs.
So just ignore
that. No, the economy creates jobs. Look, we recovered from this recession. All along this way, you can't, you know, there was hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of new jobs that evolved as this recession recovered. Government had nothing to do with that.
Okay. Anything else that we've missed on this topic?
No.
Okay. Thank you so much, Dave.
You're welcome. Well, that'll get me in trouble.
And that was Dave Swenson sharing his views on economic development in the state of Iowa. This is Local Talk. I'm one of your hosts, Greta Anderson. And when we come back, my co-host Ursula Rudenberg will share conversations with two guests about a related but different kind of development, Campus Town development in Ames, its future and its history. Stay tuned for that.
Write this down and don't forget that the best of times ain't happened yet. The gilded age has long been done, and so many lost when the West was won. Let's go to the field, we're gonna do some work. Spend our days digging in the dirt. We'll hope the rain follows the plow. This piece of ground is a homestead now. Little piece of ground is a homestead now. Three square meters and a living wage reminds me of the good old days before the manifest destiny of the factory farms, when those cutthroats came and burned down the barn. Underneath the black locust tree, there's a shady place that waits for me to rest my bones and rest my...
And that was William Elliott Whitmore, an Iowa artist with a song entitled simply Field Song. And this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm one of your hosts, Greta Anderson. Together with me is my co-host, Ursula Rudenberg.
And today is George Washington's real birthday?
Yeah, it's somebody else very special is having a birthday today, too.
Oh, okay. Well, happy birthday. We just heard ISU economist David Swenson speak about the value of local business and in the area of job creation and what he's calling indigenous growth building on what we already have here. And Campus Town is a business district here in Ames that's been in the news a lot recently. It's an area where much is in flux and some attention is being given to what kind of businesses are receiving support. The Campus Town Action Association has a list of priorities in a 5-year strategic plan for a rejuvenating area, and one of its priorities is giving incentives to small and unique businesses in the area. To further enhance the spirit of diversity and building upon what we have here, the City of Ames created a full program for renovating building facades in Campus Town, giving Campus Town building owners the ability to apply for up to $15,000 in matching grants from the city. This was after a successful pilot project last year when the Cranford Building and West Street Deli made improvements with grant money. Other changes are in the works as well. The Ames Tribune reported last week that a new apartment complex is set to be built at 118 and 120 Hayward Avenue, and the buildings where Night Owl Print and Copy, India Palace, and the Scallion Restaurants are located. So we were interested in the history of this building and this area, and a little bit later we'll be having a historian who's researching the history of Campus Town talk a little bit about what Hayward Street has meant in the past and where it's headed. However, yesterday, Nitin Gadia, a resident of Ames, stopped by KHOI to talk about another aspect of development in the area of Campus Town. This is more on the subject of public space. He's been working on an initiative for 2 years and recently announced it publicly following a time-honored tradition in Ames of independent citizen initiatives being brought to the city for collaboration. I asked Nitin to explain his project, and this is some of what he said.
Wherever I am, more and more, when I walk down a street, I like to look at a place and just imagine the potential of this place. So one time I was walking around in Campus Town, back in that parking area behind Fighting Burrito, and I just saw everything appear in front of me, you know, like all the backs of the buildings, they're all like, you know, run down. There's trash everywhere. It's just a bunch of dead space, a bunch of concrete, a bunch of litter. But just thinking, imagine what this place could look like and what this place could be thriving with people, just full of people, if it was made into a space that was beautiful, that people cared about, that people went there and sought out. Then people would sweep that street and just do everything that they can to make it work for them. I've been to places where there are really good public spaces where it's just full of people all the time. The Iowa City Ped Mall is amazing. It's just full of students. It's full of people. It's just alive. And Campus Town in Ames is kind of like that. But if it had this kind of central social environment, this beautiful social environment could be the center of Campus Town where everybody wants to go. Make that the heart of
like central campus in a way.
Yeah, you know, like the Campanile or the Central Campus where people go and they hang out. There's a lot of seating area like in front of Parks Library. People go and hang out there when they are in and out of the library, the hub. It would be great if there was something like that in Campus Town.
Nitin, you've recently issued a release that you sent us.
Sure.
Explain what it is that you're hoping to do.
Behind Subway, Fighting Burrito, Copyworks, there's a large parking area. It's all just pavement. And basically, the long-term ideal is to turn that whole area into a commons pedestrian area, which basically would then be a kind of another entrance for the businesses that are along that parking area.
What exactly is a commons?
Like a town square. People also use the word ped mall. It'll just be kind of a gathering space for people. Like a community space surrounded by buildings. Taking out that whole area would be a little bit contentious because there's a public parking back there. But we're focusing right now on a small area that will not require any parking or any disturbance to any business.
And which area is that?
The northeast portion of that streetscape. It's a very small area. It would directly behind the district and Copyworks. Those businesses can then use it. Also, Mickey's would use it.
What's there right now?
Right now, there's nothing but litter and cracked concrete.
So you're proposing to make that an inviting space that where people would want to be?
Right, yeah. Basically, put some barriers like with plants and things like that and seating and paint the surfaces. And that'll basically make it into like community living room, if you could put it that way, where people can just go and hang out in between things. And Mickey's in the district already have porches there where, especially during the warm weather, people hang out back there. So it would be just an excellent place for people to just hang out.
And how will you let people know that the space is available for them to be in? Because it's kind of hidden from the public.
Actually, there are a couple porches back there where people hang out all the time. And basically, if you just kind of make that available visibly to people, people will just kind of go back there. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty confident of that. Go back there during a weekend. It's full of people, actually, already, kind of building and improving what's already there. And yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. This has been a couple years in the making, just going around and asking people if they're supportive of and things like that. And so
does the city own this space?
Yes. We're needing to take this proposal for this small area to city council for them to approve it to be blocked off. And we're only going to do it for a year to start. It'll just be kind of a year-long experiment to see how it all works. And we're not asking for any money from the city or anything like that. It'll just be a very simple thing like, can we use this space?
What do you do about the issue of liability if you are given control over this space?
That's why I formed Campus Town Square, a nonprofit corporation, to have that liability for the space. And we've been quoted by an insurance company $200, $300 a month, basically, to have insurance for that space to be liable for it. Mm-hmm. I'm confident that that's not going to be a problem.
Who's planning to do the work?
I feel that once people feel that this is a viable project and that it has potential of happening, that people will be willing to engage in it. And it really wouldn't require a great deal of maintenance and effort. One person can even do it.
I
would go there
yourself.
If I had to do it myself, yes. I'm confident that it would not have to come to that, but it's something that even one person can do, yes. I kind of follow this philosophy of called light, quick, and cheap. You know, we like to think that a lot of work goes into making something usable, but actually there's very little that you really need to do to improve a space. We could do it over the course of a couple weeks.
And you're doing this to, in a way, as a test case?
Yeah, just to make it easier for people to be willing to try it out, I guess. So,
if you're able to get permission from the city to section off the space,
mm-hmm.
and it goes well, what happens then?
Maybe a couple months before it ends, we'll approach the city and ask if we can just make this permanent. Also, additionally, we're going to maybe make an effort to expand into the rest of the area, which would require issues being dealt with parking.
So ultimately, you would envision this community space involving that whole parking lot back there?
Ideally, yes, but we're starting with something that should have no problems at all.
The long-term goal to possibly turn the whole parking area behind the businesses in Campus Town that's now a parking lot into a public pedestrian space. But the short-term goal is right now to ask the city to designate a area in the northeast corner of that parking lot area into a public space.
Right. That will not remove any parking or have any issues with disruption. We're going to put plants, places to sit, paint the surfaces, etc. And we would love it if people were involved with that in any way they wanted to.
But what do you think would allow the city to approve something like this?
I've approached the city about this for a couple years now, and they really want there to be a wider support across the community. So this meeting will try to basically gather support. I'm trying to piece together a group of people who would ensure to the city that this would be a viable project in terms of it being something that would be maintained and it would be done well. That's why we all need people to participate in it in any way you can, whether it's just coming to the public meetings that we're having or to the council meetings or talking to people about it, even just talking about it on Facebook. That goes a long way.
If somebody listening to this is interested in this project, what should they do?
just show up to the meeting. You don't have to even necessarily be willing to provide something. If you just show up to the meeting, it means a lot. It's a time when we can all talk about this idea and talk about Campus Town. If you use Facebook, go to Campus Town Square. It's a Facebook group. You can find any number of updates there. There's also the website, campustownsquare.org. campustownsquare.org. If you go there, you can also get updates and learn all about the project. We'll be having a meeting in early March, and just stay tuned for when that meeting is. Go to the Facebook page, and there'll be an announcement in the paper, and it'll be posted on the website. If you want to contact me directly, my phone number is listed on the website, campustownsquare.org, campustownsquare.org.
You talk like somebody who's trying to start a project that a lot of people will support and give input on.
Right. Hopefully a lot of people will come to the meeting in early March. I don't want to be the only person doing it. I want everybody to be involved.
So what is your plan for getting all these people involved?
I think that people will get behind this. Slowly people are coming in since I sent the press release out like a few days ago. Like even today I received an email from the professor at Iowa State. Her name is Nadia Anderson. She's at the ISU Community Design Lab. They do real world projects. This is a great project, I think, for them. People all over the country are starting to move back into the urban cores, even in Ames. People are moving back into our downtowns for various reasons, and we need to have a more balanced way of developing things, and I hope that this can be a part of improving that situation.
So you see yourself as part of a generation that wants to move back into the urban core,
yes,
of the community.
Right, right.
And am I understanding correctly that this plan that you're proposing is really about quality of life in the urban cores?
Yeah, this specific project is developing pedestrian and community commonly owned environment, fostering a sense of place and community, which is the most important thing that any place can have.
What is this project called?
Campus Town Square.
Campus Town Square.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Do you think it can happen?
I think that it can happen, and I'm confident it will happen. This project is entirely doable if we did have the space available for us to use. The biggest impediment has basically been people's attitudes about it, that this is a huge project. You talk to one group of people, and they say, have you talked to this group of people? You talk to that group of people, they say, have you talked to this group of people? And I've talked to everybody about it, but that's all what they say. I grew up in Ames. I have stuck around, and I wanted to try to start doing things that'll make Ames a better place.
Can you explain that a little bit?
I feel like we need to, in America and in just modern society in general, we need to reorient the way that things have developed. We've become kind of out of touch with each other, with community. And I found that when it comes to making things happen, people have to say that they support this project and not necessarily make it contingent on whether other people support it as well.
Based on its own merit.
Based on its own merit, exactly.
And you feel this project has merit?
Yes, it has merit, and it's small, it's doable. It'll bring the most positive impact to Campus Town. When I look around in Campus Town, I see so much potential. It could become one of the best campus towns in the country, just like Iowa State is one of the best campuses in the country. And that's all because of the way the buildings are arranged and the space in between, the campanile, and it's just very well laid out. Campus Town is too much of a hodgepodge. It's too chaotic, you know. We need to have a sense of place. It has so much potential that is untapped and requires a space like this. No place worth caring about does not have a common space, which Campus Town does not. It's to have something where people feel like they're in Campus Town, like it's a place. And it's also a place worth caring about. I think that that's what this effort will start to bring.
And this is Local Talk on KHOI, where we explore people's stories and events in Central Iowa. We were just listening to an interview with Nitin Gadia, who's a resident of Ames and who has the ambition to bring a proposal before the Ames City Council for establishing a more developed public space in Campus Town, much in the spirit of a town square. Again, for information about this project, or if you're interested in attending a meeting that he wants to have with you, you can find information at campustownsquare.org. Before hearing from Nitin, I mentioned that the Ames Tribune had recently reported that a new apartment complex is set to be built at 118 and 120 Hayward Avenue in the buildings where Night Owl Print and Copy the India Palace and the Scallion Restaurants are located. These two buildings have been really fixtures on Hayward for many years, so we were curious about their history as they are being slated for demolition. Anthony Capps is a writer here in Ames who is researching the history of Campus Town for a book, and he agreed to come in and tell us about these buildings, which will soon belong to the historical archives. Thank you for coming, Anthony.
Thank you.
Anthony, tell us a little bit about the two buildings that are coming down. One is what I've always known as Campus Plaza, which was kind of a low, large building that kind of filled that space there. Mm-hmm. And kind of looks like an old garage or an old factory. What actually was that building built for?
Are you talking about 118?
Yeah.
118 is now a multipurpose. It was a garage for most of its history. It was built to be a garage. It was built sometime right before World War II, around 1939. And, I mean, if you do look at it, and you do look at it really closely, you can see a lot of the old garage remnants of it, the large windows that have been filled in for many years now. But it was built in the 30s. It was specifically, it was for a garage that also really struggled during the wartime, just because the people who were supposed to take it over, the sons of the Watoff, I believe was the name of the family, his sons were initially supposed to take it over, and they had to leave to go to service during World War II. So Dad decided to hang around, tried to keep it up in shape. Then when they returned from the war, they eventually did take it over, and they outgrew the place. Their operation moved elsewhere because that space just wasn't large enough for them. I think they even did an expansion to that building, but they outgrew it in 55, 56.
And the garage was for which cars? Was it a public garage or a private garage?
It was a private garage. The family really made their business in Studebakers. Mm-hmm. They were the go-to dealer. They also had a lot more business than a lot of other places in Ames for their time, because a dealership also did pop up eventually, and the garage itself did close up, I think, the end of 1955.
And what about 120, the building where the India Palace is right now?
That building, I'm not quite sure when it was actually built, but I know for several residents that have been around for a long time, that would have been a laundry, cleaners, tailors.
It was a dry cleaners for many years,
that
yes.
was actually, from what I could find, and I haven't gone back, the research isn't complete, just because I haven't tapped into every newspaper's archive yet at this point. But the earliest that I found it is 1937 is the oldest record that I can find that Lindquist Cleaners has been located there. So, mm-hmm. And before that, I know there's at least 1 year in an old directory that does list it as a real estate. It was the person that owned it, so I'm guessing that at least that building was there. I'm not sure if Lindquist was there yet, but the building was at least probably standing there.
Okay, thank you. Anthony is writing a book about the history of Campus Town. Any other comments about Hayward Avenue before we close?
I think it is worth noting that that specific part of Hayward isn't original to the Campus Town layout. When Campus Town was first laid, that part of Campus Town was first laid out, it didn't actually, it stopped at Chamberlain. So there was no access from Chamberlain and from Hunt all the way to Lincoln Way. It wasn't until about 1916, until about another 15 years later, that was actually extended, that they finally decided to build over the creek there, because that creek was just so much of a hassle. No one wanted to put the time in to try and build a road over it.
Wow, so that was outside of town. Hayward was outside of town.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Wow. Okay, well, thank you so much for giving us a little background. Please come back again and talk with us more about Campus Town.
Yeah, absolutely.
And as we say farewell to 118 and 120 Hayward Avenue. And it'll be replaced by student housing, a housing apartment building.
Yep.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we have just been joined in the studio by Jennifer L. Knox of Nevada, Iowa. She's going to send us off today with a couple of poems. Jennifer's latest book of poems, Days of Shame and Failure, from the publisher Bloof Books, was recently reviewed in the New York Times, which is a pretty big deal. And she's been traveling around and about the country sharing her poems. And so we are lucky to have her right here in central Iowa and to share her poems whenever she feels like it.
Woo-hoo.
So, and evidently she will be on our poetry show, Firsthand Poetry with Brett.
I think this Wednesday.
This Wednesday.
This Wednesday night. I think it's 8:30 to 9.
Okay, so we only get a tiny sampling this moment, but we will get more on Wednesday. So start us off, Jennifer, with a poem.
This is a poem called The Yellow Rose. It's about when I took my parakeet, my first trip to the vet school with my parakeet, who was not long for this world. It was shortly after I moved to Ames. This is called The Yellow Rose. She'd done it once before, last fall, stood on one foot, the other drawn up like a clenched fist. She was that way 1 week, dragging the bad half of her body up and down the cage bars like a heavy sled. Female parakeets, the vet said, have one ovary on the left leg. When inflamed, it can paralyze the whole left side. It doesn't hurt, though. It's numb. She got a shot and was fast back to two legs. So when it happened again, this time on the right, I told the new vet, just give her that shot. He showed me, among her yellow feathers, where to feel for the tumor, big as a marble at the top of her skinny pink leg. What were the odds? Paralyzed twice in one life. The first time, simply solved. The next, not. She's from Texas, he said, smiling at her. He'd looked up the number on her ankle band. And there we are, in the hands of strangers, still discovering basic things about ourselves, like where we came from, right up to the end.
Hmm. And you said this doctor was a...
The doctor is at the vet school, and the doctor is actually a she. I forget the doctor's name. I think it begins with a Z. But she's the
Saffirano.
That's it. And she's awesome. But I couldn't have two she's in the poem, so somebody had to be a he.
Ah,
so it was the vet.
Okay.
Because I wanted Philip, the parakeet, to remain a she.
Oh, Philip is a she.
Philip was a she.
Obviously,
yes.
She had ovaries. Or
yes.
An ovary.
An ovary. Just one. Isn't that... It's amazing. Huh?
Okay.
Yeah.
We're going to squeeze in one more poem.
One more.
And just for all of you, this is Jennifer L. Knox. She's in today's Des Moines Register, so check her out there.
Yeah, yesterday in Iowa Life. So that was real fun. This one of the things I've loved to do since I've moved to Ames is hunt mushrooms. I do it with my friends and family. And I saw an article about a mushroom burial suit where they put you in the suit and the mushrooms grow and break down the body after you've died.
Yeah.
So this is called The Mushroom Burial Suit. Screwed onto a silky stem with one arm buried to the elbow in a skirt of breathy gills, a smooth hill of snow caps traced the nose, once sneezing, the shoulders, once shuddering, and the paunch, once hanging over a waistband. Busy bees, the spores fly below the eye's radar to lay and lay down their carpet. Soon, seamless as fondant, they'll break down the splitting skin, blood, bones, and acorns sprouting in the now vacant mouth, down, down through a life of fretting and flurry to the ground, thriving under.
Awesome.
Thanks.
Jennifer L. Knox, she'll be reading more poems and talking about her work at 8:30 on Wednesday evening with Brett Brinkmeyer. All right, you've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in central Iowa. We've been your hosts, Greta Anderson and Ursula Rudenberg. We started out the show with David Swenson of the Iowa State Department of Economics talking about what he sees as failed economic development strategies at the state level.
Then we heard an interview with Nitin Gadia about his vision for public space development in Campustown, and Anthony Capps, who filled us in on some of the history of Campustown.
And finally, Jennifer L. Knox reading two poems from her book, Days of Shame and Failure. Local Talk will be rebroadcast at noon and 7 p.m. You can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. There you will also find information about our guests, along with relevant links to today's stories. And you can like us on Facebook and get updates on all of our show postings in your news feed.
Local Talk was engineered today by Nadia Abdel-Azim, and our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards, as usual, from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard was Field Song by William Ellett Whitmore.
Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878. That's 292-2878, or contact us through our website, khoifm.org.
If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. And remember, your participation as the listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thank you for listening, and see you again on the radio.